The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. Once again, I am the symposium editor, Michael Scheimer, and I'm going to introduce our environmental panel today. We have Matthew Auer, who is the dean at Hutton Honors College, Indiana University, and the professor of public and environmental affairs. As I understand, is the dean of the environmental policy school overall, correct?
No.
he's a dean, but he's also very qualified to talk about environmental policy. Then after him, we have Ruth Greenspan Bell, who's a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute and has worked on issues in Eastern Europe and spent some time with the EPA, from what I understand, in the past. And then lastly, we have Dr. Alexander Goulub, senior research fellow with the Environmental Defense Fund, who will talk about his presentation will follow. It will be the last one we have planned for this evening. So it's afternoon, I'm sorry. And after that, we will go what we've done before and open up the floor to questions, again, using the mics over here. So after our speakers are done, I'll come up and open the floor again. So
thank you, Michael, and David, and Inessa, and to the students in the American University International Law Review. It's an honor to be part of this really excellent program, and I've enjoyed all the sessions today. And there'll be hopefully some consistency with the remarks that I'll make now with that of the morning session with Mr. Coburn, who presented some information about the energy context in Russia and Europe generally. Mr. Coburn himself mentioned that Russia has the largest reserves of natural gas in the world, and they're also the largest producer of natural gas in the world. Note that although they produce a lot of natural gas, they're not exporting all of it. In fact, domestically they use a lot of their natural gas, which has some interesting policy implications of its own in terms of energy efficiency or lack thereof. The European Union is very dependent on Russian gas, somewhere between 25% and 30% of all its natural gas that it uses is imported from Russia. And most of that is coming through transit routes, through the transit pipeline in Ukraine. The Ukrainian transit route has its own interesting history. Ironically, it's actually a product of the Cold War, when West Germany wanted to avoid having that transit route routed through East Germany. And the Soviet Union was okay with that. They just built the pipeline further south through Ukraine, which at that time was part of the Soviet Union. So this is really the product of that Cold War experience. Different countries have different levels of dependence on natural gas from Russia in Europe. What I call the old EU countries, the amount of dependence is variable. Some countries like Finland are highly dependent in terms of their gas supply, but they have other alternatives besides gas. They have some oil, for example. Many other Western European countries are only getting a fraction of their gas from Russia. On the other hand, the countries in the south and the southeast part of Europe, the newer accession countries, the European Union, and then what I call would-be accession countries, countries that have expressed interest in joining the EU eventually, some of them are very dependent. In some cases, all of their imported gas is coming from Russia. And again, most of that would be coming through the pipeline in Ukraine. In fact, there are multiple pipelines. The most important is the Brotherhood pipeline. The name is sort of ironic now, in light of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine over the gas trade. But there are other pipelines, and there are proposed pipelines. Now, from the perspective of Europe, which is concerned about its energy security in light of this now recurring dispute between Ukraine and Russia over gas, when you look at this map of proposed pipelines, none of them are completely satisfactory. You have the Yamal routes that run through Belarus. That's not really ideal. The Nord Stream route is one that's in, that for which there's considerable excitement with both Europeans and Russians. Russia is excited because there would be no transit state to go through in the form of Ukraine. This would be a very important new source of supply for Germany, for the United Kingdom. Maybe up to a trillion cubic feet of natural gas a year could come through this pipeline when it's developed. Incidentally, Riga and Warsaw were very angry when this arrangement was made for this pipeline because they weren't consulted. So with all of the pipeline projects, there are politics and there's gamesmanship. The dream pipeline for many of the European countries and for the United States that's been discussed for many years is this Nabucco pipeline, which runs through Turkey and connects to existing pipelines through Georgia all the way east to Baku, and then would depend on gas coming from Turkmenistan. Why is it a dream pipeline for European countries and for the United States? Because it wouldn't run through Russia. But Mr. Putin, both in his prime ministerial and presidential incarnations, has really outfoxed the European company consortium in the United States in terms of wrapping up not just the supply side for gas, but also downstream customers for gas by, among other things, proposing and now going forward with an alternative pipeline which would reach the very same customers. That's this South Stream pipeline, which would run through the Black Sea. He last year signed a memorandum of understanding with Greece, with Bulgaria, and I believe with Austria to deliver gas to the very same customers who would otherwise be getting gas through this Nabucco proposed pipeline. Other things to think about are the fact that the existing pipeline that runs through Georgia and Azerbaijan and has its own rich and storied history that goes back to the 19th century. In the conflict this past summer, this spur of the pipeline in Georgia runs just a little bit south of South Ossetia. And there were Russian tanks and armor personnel carriers crisscrossing that pipeline. The message was pretty clear to observers in the West that Russia really could call the shots when it comes to Nabucco with that portion of the pipeline. And then the other issue to think about, of course, is having a partner in the form of Turkmenistan. So continuing with to build this out a little further, Nabucco, if all of the parties come on board in terms of supply, from a Western European perspective, you're trying to avoid doing business with Russia, with Russian gas. Is it that much more advantageous to depend on gas from Turkmenistan, from Iran, from Ahmadinejad, or from Iraq? Iraq is pretty quiet right now, relatively speaking, relative to 2006. But American combat troops are supposed to leave by 2007. I'm sorry, by 2011 and perhaps earlier. So all of those well, I've lost my monitor here. It's back. None of those really should make European customers with the Nabucco pipeline feel very confident. There are many interesting legal issues to consider, but again, from the European security perspective, the key ones recently have to do with prices. Russia likes long-term contracts for gas. It guarantees an income stream so that Russia can go ahead and develop other gas fields, which are very capital intensive. It provides a steady income for Russia. And it locks in prices, and if you can lock in high prices, that's a good thing. Now, you can also get burned on the other side. Prime Minister Putin actually locked in very high prices for gas delivery from Central Asia to Russia this past fall, right at the peak of the market. I think something on the order of maybe $318 or $320 per trillion cubic feet, which is very high. Now, the region, natural gas prices are sensitive on a regional basis, Russia is capable of getting maybe a third of that back. This may have actually been part of the reason why they were pushing so hard on Georgia to renegotiate gas contracts in January because of this nasty price contract that they signed with Central Asia. So all of these things are connected. If you are a European customer, you might prefer to buy your gas through a spot price contract, take advantage of down markets for natural gas like you have now, but Russia doesn't want to play that game. So most of these long-term contracts, as my colleague Mr. Coburn mentioned this morning, are genuinely long-term, some of them 10-year contracts. One of the problems with these long-term contracts is that they make it very difficult, they create barriers to entry for independent producers. And any number of European countries in the United States would like to see the Gazprom monopoly have a challenge by some of the independent producers. That's really hard to do with long-term price contracts. Meanwhile, regardless of whether you have short-term price contracts or long-term price contracts, you still have this transit state issue with Ukraine. They have a lot of leverage because they've got the most important pipeline and they can charge fees. They get subsidized gas through the system by virtue of being the transit state, so they have some leverage. What can Europe do about this? Should they go in the direction of that Nabucco pipeline and depend on some of the other gas pipeline projects? Well, that means that they're jumping in bed with Turkmenistan, maybe Iran and Iraq instead of with Russia. Not necessarily a long-term solution. Should you build liquefied gas terminals in places like Greece, Italy, maybe the Dalmatian coast in Croatia, perhaps Bulgaria? These are very expensive to build. They also are expensive for gas exporters on the export end who would be sending it to these LNG terminals in Europe. So people talk about, oh, well, they just need these LNG terminals, but they're very expensive to very capital-intensive options. Something that I've been thinking about writing about is investing in alternative energy. It's not the complete answer, but in part because Europe, especially in the southern tier, is there's a fair bit of low-hanging fruit because they've done so little. One issue for them to think about is that Russian gas fields are aging anyway. There's still plenty of gas to be tapped, but some of the most important fields, the best developed fields, and hence the ones that have the biggest sunk costs, are aging, and so alternative energy might make sense. As you know, European countries have Kyoto obligations, and natural gas doesn't really get you all the way there because there's still some carbon. It's a hydrogen-intensive fuel, but you can't just depend on natural gas. Coupled with these other security issues, you might think about generating electricity from other sources, including, for example, solar. So the colored image that you see here is showing you rates of irradiation in different parts of Europe, places like Italy, Greece, parts of Bulgaria, parts of Croatia have real promise for solar radiation. And it reminds me of a question that was asked this morning of Mr. Coburn. He says, well, you need a European solution to deal with the energy and security problem. Actually, you can have very decentralized solutions on a European state level or a sub-regional level to deal with some of these insecurity issues with alternative energy, for example. Another possibility, largely uncontemplated at this point, are biomass crops. A lot of rice is grown in places like Italy, Greece, Bulgaria. Rice husks, it turns out, as an otherwise a waste product, is very intensive in hydrogen, and that's an important feedstock for new synthetic fuels that can be used in place of natural gas. It deals with the greenhouse gas problem as well. It's quite promising, and it has implications for a very sticky issue for Europe, and that is its trade policies in agriculture. Agricultural trade policies are very discriminatory against Africa, for example, with regard to cane sugar. It's hard for African farmers, poor farmers, to compete with subsidized sugar beet growers in Europe. If you could shift agriculture, if you're going to play the game of export subsidies, which and other kinds of subsidies that Europe uses, then perhaps you could, if that's a something that's a third rail issue for Europe, and it appears to be, then maybe we should be subsidizing not crops that are valuable for export, but are valuable for alternative energy like biomass crops. So here's some of the things that I'm thinking about. And thanks for your attention.
Hi, I'm Ruth Bell. I wanted to thank the organizers for inviting me to this, and I'm going to use my 10 minutes in the sun to kind of think out loud about some things I've been trying to get straight in my own mind lately. I have worked for probably two decades now on environmental assistance projects, starting off first in the former Soviet bloc and then later in a lot of places in Asia. And when we started working in Russia, was me at EPA in 1991 or 1992, I can't remember exactly what it was, we were very optimistic that we could actually, we're very idealistic in many ways, that we could actually kind of, you know, make a dent in the Russian environmental problems. I see if I turn my head this way, I lose the microphone. So I'm not ignoring you there. I'm just going to have to talk into the mic. And in fact, you know, Matt was involved with those issues. I met him two decades ago in Warsaw, and I met Dr. Golub. Actually, I remember specifically, there was a dinner at the Kempinski Hotel when all of the advisors who were working out relationships with Russian partners, and that included EPA and USAID and the World Bank, where we were all putting together these, as I say, very idealistic plans to try to get a grip on Russia's considerable pollution problem. I dare say, you know, it's been two decades, and I love the efforts we made. I made a lot of good friends in Russia and elsewhere, but I don't think we really made a dent in these problems. And I think that, and reflecting on my experience in Asia, I think, you know, in similar projects, I'm similarly worried about the results there. Now, I have to be very honest, you know, when I was working in these projects, I came home so that if pollution in a city in China or Russia was so terrible that I, you know, my chest started aching after a certain amount of time, I eventually came home to the United States and my chest cleared and I could breathe. But now I realize, especially as we are all focusing on climate change, that it's not a problem you can walk away from and leave behind. I mean, we know now that Chinese acid rain is falling on the west coast of the United States of America. We know that environmental choices all over the world are having impacts on all of us. So there's no, you know, the old cliches about pollution knows no borders. Well, it's true. You know, we are at this sort of rather, I think, kind of desperate state that we're really not facing up to. And I say desperate not advisedly, because if you look at, you know, the climate science, we are on a trajectory right now. If we continue with business as usual, there's an MIT model, I can give you the link if you want to ask me later, that projects that we have something like a high 90s, I think it's a 96% chance of something pretty close to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. I always like to use Fahrenheit because in America people hear centigrade and they automatically think, they translate in their heads Fahrenheit to the same number. It's not true. It's almost double. That we're you know, looking at a very, very high Fahrenheit increase by about 2100. And, you know, can the world, can civilization as we currently know it tolerate that kind of increase? Well, I think the answer is pretty clearly no. We're going to lead very, very different lives, and there are going to be far fewer of us or crowded into particular spaces. So I guess the reason why I'm sort of going through this long history is because this is where we are, and we have to think about where we need to go with these issues. And I am not optimistic that we made much of a dent in our work in Russia on on the powers that be. I don't think they take the environment terribly seriously. I just spent 18 months working in Poland, a country I dearly love, and I lived in Warsaw for the last 6 months, and my job there was a job I made up, but eventually got support for, to help the Poles, who were hosts at the last, as you probably know, the last conference of the parties in Poznan was hosted by Poland, the climate negotiations. And eventually I put together a task force, all of whom were Polish except for me, to support the work of the Polish climate ambassador. So I was sort of deeply embroiled in, you know, in Poland during this time and, you know, seeing close up how Poland was dealing with the climate issues. And the answer is they weren't dealing with the climate issues. It was a kind of a fluky thing that they ended up hosting Poznan. I don't think it was taken very seriously for a long time. In the end, they did a fabulous logistic job, I have to say, probably logistically the best COP that's ever been put on, but it made no progress whatsoever. And the most telling moment to me was when I was told reliably by two people that Prime Minister Tusk, you know, it's a parliamentary system, so he's the prime minister, and he came to open the COP on the opening day. And he was surprised to walk in the room and find out that it was not a room full of environmental freaks. He expected, you know, here were a lot of substantive people in this room from all over the world, serious diplomats, and yet because of an attitude issue, which I suspect is sort of very similar in Russia, although I haven't, you know, worked in Russia in the last couple of years, it sort of represents what I know about the leadership's view about these things. This is the challenge we are dealing with. We are dealing with, even with countries that, you know, use the right words in the climate debate, a very, very shallow at best understanding of the consequences, seriousness of it, and a sense that somehow it's not me. It's somebody else's problem. It's not my problem. And I heard seriously argued the other night at a dinner party somebody who said that Russia would be a net benefiter from climate change. And as near as I could tell, it's the assumption of this is that somehow you can close a wall around Russia and it doesn't engage with the rest of the world, but it has, you know, more places where it can plant, grow, you know, crops, assuming that that really works there, because we know now that, you know, that the balance of nature is out of whack, so that just planting crops doesn't necessarily get you the crops you want in this kind of setting. But the main point is there still pertains, I believe in Russia too, this sort of sense that somehow they're exempt from this, that this is not a problem, that they're going to survive this. In fact, they're not only going to survive it, they're going to do really well in it because they're going to find more oil and gas up in the Arctic and ship it off and be rich. You know, so we're dealing with this sort of degree of unreality with respect to an extremely, extremely serious problem. The tack I'm sort of trying to take in Poland as kind of a case example of what we might be thinking about elsewhere is to try to think about, we did an exercise in Warsaw actually last week, and we tried to think about, okay, let's assume that Prime Minister Tusk was impressed that there were serious people in the room, but he still, you know, climate change isn't anywhere on his agenda. Natural gas is, and energy security is. And, you know, so why are we talking? Maybe we can find other doors into the mindset of leaders like this to address with them things they do care about. They clearly care about energy security, their actual national security, and try to see whether employment, jobs, the economy, growing the economy, and see whether we can't use the connections between those things and climate to have a more constructive conversation, to engage leadership in countries like this in a more constructive way. And I'm going to conclude with just giving you two examples of how I think this can be done. I don't think it can be done through law. I'm sorry, I'm a lawyer by training, but what we've seen in Russia, frankly, is, it was discussed in the earlier panel, selective prosecution. So there have actually been examples recently of official Russia remembering that it has environmental laws at a convenient point when it wants to take in after companies or leaders of companies that it doesn't like very much. So the BP situation, where part of what they articulated as their rationale for beating up on BP was BP's supposed violations of the environmental law. So this is not going to get us anywhere, in my opinion. But I'll talk about two things I did in Poland. One thing I did was I brought two people to Poland to talk about energy security and climate change as a national security issue. There was a wonderful report issued probably almost about 2 years ago here in the United States by 11 retired admirals and generals. And I brought one of those retired generals to Poland, and I actually also brought former CIA Director Jim Woolsey to Poland. And the theme that they, let me focus in on the retired general. He interestingly started off his conversations with people saying, you know, I've looked at the climate science and I'm not 100% believer. I have some concerns here, some quibbles here. But as a defense professional, I cannot wait until the last piece of evidence drops into place. The whole rationale of being a military planner is you look at risk as it is and you plan accordingly. And he felt, and this panel of retired military officers felt, that that there was enough evidence to know that something was going wrong, and you had to plan. You had to plan for that eventuality. You might turn out to be wrong in the long run, but if you didn't plan for it and it came about, it was too late to do the kind of planning you needed to do. Jim Woolsey talked about his plug-in Prius, among other things. His theme here, and it's a very big neocon theme that, you know, is used by a lot of prominent neocons. I don't like their politics too much, but I really love them on this one, is that we are sending good dollar after bad dollar off to people who don't like us very much. And why are we doing that? And Woolsey talks about his plug-in Prius, and he gets 100 miles to the gallon on his plug-in Prius now. So he's, you know, so there's that argument. There are other arguments too. You know, you can talk about green opportunity. You can talk about getting ahead of the curve in terms of research. Poland is very, very, very dependent on domestic coal. It's very proud of that. It calls itself the Saudi Arabia of Europe for coal, and but we all know the problems with coal. Eventually, you know, Poland is part of the European Union, and there are going to be pressures on Poland to make some changes. They could be getting the head of the curve in terms of applying their great universities, their great technical universities, to thinking about, you know, carbon capture and storage, carbon capture and treatment, other kinds of, you know, better improved technology that they can then sell later, rather than having to be, when the crisis really comes, having to go out there and buy other people's technology. So this is kind of my, you know, 10 minutes thinking out loud on where I think we have to be thinking about climate change. I recognize that Russia is not the most important country in the climate change equation. You know, a year ago, if you'd said that Poland wasn't the most important country, it turns out that Poland upset the entire European Union by challenging, by putting together a coalition challenging the European climate package, and Poland and the European Union was in such disarray that they didn't have any sort of, you know, organizing principles to work together in the in COP14 in the meetings in December, and there was, as a result, no engine pulling the COP forward because the U.S. was on the sidelines too. So, you know, these countries are countries that you may not think are important for climate reasons, may turn out to be because of unique issues like where they're positioned geographically, their resource dependency and things like that. And I think actually the bottom line for me is we have to start thinking a lot more clearly and carefully about how do you talk to those countries and how do you get them into the fold. Now, just one more caveat, which is I understand none of this can happen until our own country gets into the fold in a real way, but we've suddenly started that, addressing our carbon problem, and I feel quite confident that as time goes forward, we're going to be in a better position to do that. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me. I'm an economist, and actually I'm quite comfortable in that kind of audience, because in Environmental Defense Fund, my office was just between, in one office was Joe Goffman and another office Annie Pitsong, or both of them were lawyers, and then I feel myself kind of in average exposed to legal issues. I remember this dinner in Kempinski Hotel, and I think we had a lot of very good ideas. And now you provoked me to think what has been done since that. And I think we have one important accomplishment. I think we managed to deliver a message to top Russian leaders that environmental issues are one of the most important priorities for Western world. And as long as Russia would like to be part of Western world, and this intention is in reverse correlation to oil prices, now it's a perfect moment. So then environmental issues becomes more important in Russia. We managed to deliver that message, and Kremlin understand this very well, and we actually was another benefit of this Russia ratified Kyoto Protocol, not because Russia want to benefit from emission trading and other benefits related to Kyoto Protocol, because Kyoto Protocol was important for European Union. Meeting in Poland was not very successful, and my opinion is not necessarily represent opinion of my organization. I think that we should not expect too much from meeting in Copenhagen. What does it mean? That it means that it probably we are looking for another agreement, another international agreement, and then Russia will play important role, because in terms of fossil fuel emission, Russia takes third place, and if we take into account deforestation and other non-CO2 emission, then Russia still keep fifth place. So then I think with that remark, I start my presentation. Is that a point that I'd like to make? It is an important accomplishment, but it's probably not enough to advance environmental policy in Russia, just to constantly rely on pressure from outside. And in fact, definitely we need to come to a situation when Russia realizes that sustainable economic growth has one important element, environmental and energy and climate policy. And if you look at this picture, I think it's quite self-explanatory. You have obvious link between over-industrialization, which makes economic growth in Russia not sustainable. Russian economic growth heavily depends on energy, and not only on revenue from oil and natural gas export, but also on overdeveloped energy sector in country. Also, this is important issue from point of view of global pollution, because Russia has very high GDP carbon emission, and also local air pollution. And I think perhaps local air pollution is the issue that at least local authorities start to look at. I just tell you one brief story. In 2006, we released results of the study published by Environmental Defense. We have a few copies here, but you can easily get that from our website. This report discusses mortality and morbidity attributed to air pollution. And we reported data for Moscow City. And it was quite good media coverage. And then next morning, head of Moscow Environmental Protection Committee got a phone call from Mayor Lushkov's office. And with one question, who gave them data? I think for me it's quite good indication. So they, first of all, they watch TV, and then second, they pay attention to that. Well, and those are numbers. And as you can see, it's nearly 100,000 cases of premature mortality attributed to air pollution in Russia. So it's quite high if you compare with traffic accident, TB, assaults. So that's sizable. And of course, people may question methodology, but at least 50 and not more than 150,000 could be attributed to air pollution. And of course, in Russia, because Russia has a lot of natural gas, and then it was quite a legitimate policy for Russia to cut air pollution just to using more natural gas and fuel mix. But of course, eventually Russia will pay for that kind of climate policy, because demand for natural gas is growing and resources of natural gas are exhausting. Well, maybe not in terms of absolute numbers, but fields that are developed and ready for exploration. So, and Russia has a real threat to convert back to coal. And here is a map depict population in Russia. And this one depicts share of coal consumption in energy mix for power and heat production. And it was in 1999. And we analyzed potential for low-cost conversion for to coal from natural gas. And actually, share of natural gas could be increased dramatically, and mainly in regions that are populated. And then you, of course, would have immediate increase in SO2 and particulates emission, and then as a result, increase in acute and long-term mortality. Alternative is, of course, improvement of energy efficiency. So, yeah, that's potential change in mortality due to conversion to coal. And, of course, this this quite pessimistic, but it's quite plausible scenario. And speaking about Kyoto Protocol, for instance, potentially Kyoto Protocol could bring quite substantial revenue that could be used to improve energy efficiency, convert to alternative energy. For example, one important source of pollution is local district heating facilities. So you basically can convert to fuel wood and then reduce both carbon emission and you reduce local pollution. Of course, it requires some capital cost. So some revenues from Kyoto Protocol implementation would be a good source of capital resources to support such kind of conversion. Unfortunately, Russian government did very little to implement Kyoto Protocol. And why? Because when Russia had to make some steps to adopt relevant law to implement Kyoto Protocol, at the time oil prices went over the roof, and who would care about extra couple billion dollars of revenue in that case? So that was very low profile. So looking forward, I would say that Russia definitely has potential to improve energy efficiency and improve both air quality and reduce carbon emission. And we just in EDF, we calibrated bottom-up energy model, and those are results. That's a lot of different lines, but I'd like you to pay most attention to that one, which is which depicts lower potential emission trajectory. So that's what may happen if Russia start to break dependence of economic growth on energy sector, start to invest into alternative technologies. And this is same graph, but just with a few scenario. So basically, this graph illustrates that domestic environmental and domestic climate policy is extremely important, and we are not there yet. Unfortunately, over the last 10 years, environmental protection authorities, which was quite it was never strong and powerful in Russia, but it started to play some positive role in mid-90s, but in 2000 or in 2001, Environmental Protection Committee was abolished, and over over that time, environmental protection authorities deteriorated in Russia. So I would like to cite Joe Biden, who said that it's time to push reset button. I think when we had that dinner in Balchuk Kempinski Hotel, we had a lot of a lot of energy, a lot of ideas. What we had a very enthusiastic team from Russian side, and we had leadership from U.S. side. And I think now we have quite unique window of opportunities. On one hand, new leadership in Washington, in the White House. On another hand, Russian technocrats obviously gaining power, and it will be as long as oil prices stay low. So I think next couple of years would be good. We have good opportunity to push international agenda and try to motivate Russian authorities to push domestic agenda. Because even decision on Kyoto Protocol was taken high level, and it was quite Kremlin paid attention to decision-making process. But they made positive decision only after they were absolutely convinced that there is no plausible scenario when Russia violate Kyoto target. And after that, that was end of story. Was no motivation for Kremlin to do something, to put in place law, to do something domestically, except carbon emission inventory. Carbon emission inventory was done, and Russia has that. But no incentive, no domestic regulation, no rules for emission trading or joint implementation. We need to be sure that in next round, next agreement, it's unlikely Russia gonna get such relaxed emission target, and it will create incentives to cut, to make real steps to cut carbon emission. And because in Russia all three problems, at least for next 20 years, will be connected, then it will mean improvement air quality and hopefully some kind of drift to knowledge-based economic growth. Thank you.
Thank you, panelists. I'd like to open up the floor to questions. And again, please use the microphones in the aisles in front of you.
David Caron, if I could just offer a comment on Ruth's presentation. I was struck when you were talking about how they're disassociated from the costs of climate change, how it's a time for a net benefit. And there's a similar dynamic in the Arctic conferences that go on. And in that, and I think that's probably why I came up with the three images, in fact, because the people concerned about environment, about fishery management, they're all over in image three and relatively sober, if not overly concerned. And on the other hand, in image two, there's scientists whose research budget has increased dramatically. There's mappers, there's developers, and they're all just exuberant. And these same people are in the same room, and there's just a sort of dissonance going on in the room as you watch them interact. What was particularly effective at one conference, however, was there was land-based producers in Canada. And they spoke to the difficulties they have. They are in the other end. They are not net benefit, right? All their mines are unstable. The access roads are unstable. All of a sudden, all their operations have shifted because of what's happening. So that perhaps one of your stories is bringing in the losers in that meeting rather than just all enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Just comment on that, that one of the ironies, it's true that with melting of permafrost, it makes it pretty difficult to do, to have those roads and the oil and natural gas infrastructure footprint. And so sometimes you do hear concerns expressed by the hydrocarbon industry, but then sort of ironically, they're concerned about an industry that generates a lot of greenhouse gases. So.
Hi, I have a question. How
Dr. Golub just spoke about one potential model for growth in Russia, which is to decrease reliance on its energy sector. How likely do you think that is, given sort of the current situation in Russia and given even the gas pipelines, the gas, the reliance on the gas industry specifically that Professor Auer spoke about?
I would say that there is a chance to implement that model, but of course there are people in Kremlin who think, well, oil prices are volatile, then it will take maybe a year or two for prices to recover. We have this reserve fund. Well, somehow maybe we will overcome this period of time. Because Soviet Union was ready to start economic reforms like China started. Soviet Union was ready to start that in mid of 70s. But then they discover a new oil field, and then the oil played always not very positive role in Russia history. So understanding of benefits of improvement air quality and understanding of benefits of different economic pathway on one hand, and on another hand, keeping Russia in international agreement that will create some constraint on that type of economic growth might be helpful, but there is no guarantee.
Just wondering about the general state of environmental law in Russia. For instance, are there basic water and air pollution standards, and you know, are facilities required to put on pollution controls, things like that?
Yeah, there is basic law, and actually there are some, well, law is not bad. Problem is that Environmental Protection Authority, that was quite powerful 10 or 15 years ago, now lost its power, and the question is who's going to enforce this law. On another hand, there was some positive changes, like now health risk standards was introduced, not like a law, like sub-legal act, but each construction project should go through environmental review. Of course, then we need to take into account everything what was said today about the rule of law in Russia in general.
Just to add to that, I mean, the answer is sort of almost like a generic answer, because almost every country now has, there's hardly a country that doesn't have environmental laws, and pretty, you know, sometimes pretty good-looking environmental laws. It's not laws on the books that's the problem. It's implementation, you know, culture of compliance, enforcement, although enforcement can't be the answer. It has to be culture of compliance has to be the answer. And it's just sorely lacking a lot of places. It's a real problem. You know, following the Stockholm meetings in 72, I guess, you know, that was a big fad. Go out and write environmental laws, go out and establish an environmental ministry, but it's those next steps that are really critical and need to be taken.
I guess the one thing I would add to this is, and this harkens back to this question, but also the original comments by Ms. Greenspan Bell about what effect do we have with our aid programs in Russia. Well, not very much on the environmental side, but then again, Jeffrey Sachs was a failure on the macroeconomic side, so I don't feel that bad. But in Eastern Europe, where we were almost 20 years ago, we did have a little bit more of an impact in places like Poland, Hungary, and elsewhere. But the single most important thing in terms of law and compliance, by far, was the promise of EU accession, if those countries, those accession countries, could transpose all of that European environmental legislation, the directives, the treaty obligations, and so forth. That was by far the most important causal variable in the comparative success of, say, a Poland versus a Russia.
And that's absolutely true. And not only is it because then there's an authority there kind of looking over your shoulder the whole time, but because it also gives leverage to people within the society, places they can complain if their own country isn't doing something about these requirements. It's a slow process, but I think it's, you know, a helpful process.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Lubbers on the faculty here. And I just wanted to ask about two other environmental issues that I think exist in Russia. One is, and it was sort of brought to my attention by the nuclear dumping that Professor Caron mentioned in his presentation. And I know there are some cities that are sort of like our Love Canal type cities where there have been a lot of toxic waste dumps. Chelyabinsk, I think, is one of them. And so I'm wondering what kind of program Russia has to clean up toxic waste sites. And the second question is, you mentioned permafrost melting. And isn't that going to release a lot of methane in Siberia? And what's the consequence of that?
Well, melting permafrost, it's obvious. It's, we call that in climate models, we call it positive feedback of global warming, because methane is has warming potential 21 times more than CO2. As for nuclear waste, not field of my expertise. I don't think that there are some positive changes, but maybe you have better information.
I can't really comment with authority on the hazardous waste, toxic waste issue, the radioactive waste issue, beyond the remarks that were made this morning. One other thing, though, to add to your list would be forests in Russia. And that's connected also to the greenhouse gas issue, because Russia's boreal forests are a very key carbon sink. There's no other, outside of the tropics, there's no other country in the world that has a faster rate of deforestation than does Russia. And that's largely because of the drain of on forests from Chinese loggers. Much of it is illegal logging. There's actually a pretty good article on this in the New Yorker from a few weeks ago. Talks about this chap some of us probably have dealt with, Sasha von Bismarck, who's this sort of, he's kind of a crazy environmentalist, but he's not a radical in terms of his politics, just in terms of the crazy situations that he gets himself into. But it's kind of a probing story in the New Yorker about experience he had in trying to verify some illegal logging and some corruption in the forest industry in Russia, which is pretty telling.
Also, the forests are changing. Those forests are changing very rapidly. And I saw a presentation a summer ago by Hank Schugert at UVA, who spends a lot of time and has over, like, I don't know, 30, 40 years in Russia, and showing pictures in his own, you know, that he's taken that literally show where the edge of the forest has moved and the composition of the forest has changed. So there's an interesting question of how much we can count on that for other, as a, you know, carbon sink for other reasons.
Hi, I'm Len Coburn, independent consultant. I essentially have a comment on some of your assertions about trying to change the energy use in Russia. And how much energy efficiency could be a major player. It has been the number one issue in the energy strategies for Russia since 1991. It has fallen by the wayside every single time. Money has never been put into it. The Department of Energy had a long program with it and set up an energy efficiency center in Moscow, which was very successful. It's still there. They are essentially still opening windows to cool down apartments. They're not doing wind, they're metering. The easy things that would change the entire profile of energy use in Russia still need to be done. And so my comment is that from my perspective, what I've seen over 15 years or so, they're not serious about it. Perhaps you have a different perspective and could comment a little bit on how serious you think Russia is on energy efficiency implementation and changing their use of energy.
Well, I don't think that they have it like a top priority. Again, when Kyoto Protocol was ratified and Kremlin realized that there is no problem to fulfill this obligation, they didn't have a particular policy that encouraged energy efficiency improvements. And of course, Russia has huge potential. There are a lot of way to improve. You mentioned improvements in housing, in the household sector. There are several other ways to improve energy efficiency, but there is not much investment. We also did kind of analysis. Of course, data is not very reliable, but we didn't recognize any kind of correlation between rising fuel prices and improvement of energy efficiency. However, demand was slightly down. But I would mainly attribute that all that reduction in demand for energy, in, not in absolute, in relative terms, I will attribute that to general transition stuff, like structural changes, and then just no regret emission reduction, and maybe low cost emission reduction. So, that's bad news. Good news that potential is still there.
I just want to add one story because I was telling David Karen this. I was living in Warsaw over the last 6 months, and our offices were behind the Department of the Defense Ministry. And I was totally thrilled to get off the tram every day and walk to my office because over the course of the time I was there, they were adding insulation to the outside of this old Soviet era building, and which is a pretty ugly building, and these thick pads of insulation, and the workmen got used to me walking by every day saying, you know, Barzawadny, and, you know, giving them the high sign and stuff like that, because I thought it was cool. And at the end of it, they refinished the surface and painted it a nicer color, and the building looked a whole lot better. There's a lot of room, you know, I mean, this stuff like this is supposed to be in our stimulus package, too, all this, you know, federal buildings, which some people are complaining about, but it seems to me, you know, it puts people to work, and if it's a good argument for, you know, the guys doing it were not rocket scientists, they were just, you know, workmen who had a little bit of training, and they were doing a great job. So, you know, there's lots of win-win in this, and if people would just get to work on it.
Yeah, bring them to Northern Virginia. I live in a house built in 1955, and there is no insulation at all. So.
The stimulus package.
Yeah. Actually, I've got a question for the panelists. Ms. Greenspan-Bell, you mentioned after 20 years of working in the area that you still don't quite have faith that the legal mechanisms for environmental reform are really going to quite be enough in Russia. Can you talk about the impact or lack of impact or lack of influence of environmental groups and NGOs in Russia and Eastern Europe? Do they get heated at all, or do they get sort of silenced and anything like that?
Well, in Russia, Greenpeace and WWF, they are very active. How they find the way to handle relationship with authorities? Well, that's better to ask them, but good news that they survive and they do some useful stuff. Environmental Defense Fund contribute quite a bit kind of analytical work. We don't have problem doing that. Of course, question of data availability is always a question. And sometimes people try to sell data, sometimes people try to hide data away. So, but I think it's everywhere, more or less. In Eastern Europe. Russian domestic NGO problem is that there is no domestic sources of financial support of those NGOs. Like EDF gets money from U.S. donors. So some Russian NGO gets from U.S., from Europe, from Japan, but there is no kind of mechanism to get private donations. And I'm not quite a specialist in that area. I don't know when it may happen that situation change, but this is, I think, major problem for Russian domestic NGOs.
I can comment. One comment on this is if you look at the registry of Russian environmental NGOs, you will find that their membership often consists of the president of the organization and maybe a vice president or a treasurer. They're very small. They tend to be very issue-oriented. As Mr. Golub said, frequently they have little or no funding, and to the extent that they're connected to international NGOs, it's very hard for those Russian NGOs to cooperate with one another because they see one another as competitors for resources from the big international NGOs. So it's been very hard to get a grassroots, or institutionalized mechanism for environmental participation and environmentalism at a broad level in Russia. And that's been true for, since 1991.
The only thing I'd caution is be careful because the countries of Central Eastern Europe are all pretty different, so you can't really generalize from one to another. There's some actually small countries with extremely vibrant environmental NGOs slugging away, and there's some places where they're not very active at all or just don't seem to be able to grab the public consciousness, so it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, but again, European Regional Environmental Center, it's very powerful, great NGO, but resources, where resources come from? It's not like from private citizen.
Right.
The problem is pretty much the same. And maybe it will change. I don't know. Maybe it's some kind of environmental Kuznets curve. You need to reach some tipping point.
There are a lot of countries in Central Eastern Europe have this checkoff box when you do your taxes, and you can send, I don't know what the amount is, some amount of money off to a selected NGO. I know you can do it in Hungary and Poland and some other places. I don't know whether that's a significant source of anything, but it certainly, is a possibility. I don't think their tax structure is the same as ours in terms of how donations are treated, so that's a big problem.
One last comment. In Russia in particular, sometimes the NGOs have missed what Russians really care about when it comes to the environment. It's not like Russians don't care about nature. They love nature. I mean, mushroom picking, berry picking, in the summer is such a big deal. You can't even imagine in Russia, but it's a very decentralized endeavor. It's a family endeavor. And some of the values that people have when it comes to nature and to dachas and summer houses and mushroom picking and so forth, we haven't been able to tap that, or the NGO community hasn't really been able to tap that very effectively, in my view, in Russia.
Thank you for the answer. I actually have a completely different question from a different angle I'm about to ask Professor Howard. This is something I've personally been wondering about myself. Regarding the proposed pipelines, different routes coming from different directions, what's the environmental impact assessment done on those, and is there one or more than one that concerned environmentalists would prefer, though I'm sure they would prefer to have no gas and no oil reliance, but
In terms of ripping through the countryside, underground or above ground, who's done environmental impact assessments, and does everyone agree on those, or are there better options?
I'm also going to tug on Ms. Greenspan Bell here, because my understanding is that Russia does have something resembling the National Environmental Policy Act, which has environmental impact assessment and impact statement functions. But whether they're credible and so forth, I don't know. I know that all the pipelines, all the proposed ones, have serious environmental implications. The Baltic pipeline, there's a great deal of information with one of the slides I showed from Clean Coalition Baltic. You can describe the concerns that they have of studies that have been done of that pipeline. And that's probably the most transparent, because some of the studies have to be done by the Germans because they're in a consortium with the Russians and doing it. So that shows you something about the level of trust. The big complaints are about the German side, and you know they're not even really saying much about the Russian side, because it's, I don't think they're really taken very seriously. But with big infrastructure projects, there is an impact assessment process. Whether it's credible, I can't say.
I haven't looked at this recently. A few years ago, there were some brave lawsuits by environmental NGOs in Moscow, for example, trying to argue that the proposed train route for a new route between St. Petersburg and Moscow was going through a protected forest of some kind, and that they hadn't done an environmental impact statement. And I, frankly, I'd have to go back. I can't remember how far that got or whether it was successful. I haven't honestly been following it lately. There clearly are laws. It's a matter of, maybe there are some Russian law experts here who know better than I do, but it's really a matter of, you know, bringing the lawsuits, and then you have to have the guts and the resources to bring the lawsuit. And so it's kind of part of a package, not just the legal part of it.
It's definitely a matter of enforcement, like all that stuff in Sakhalin. In early 90s, it was state environmental review of Sakhalin projects, I think. Basically, each of them came. All reviews was kind of negative. And then, of course, 10 years later, when it was necessary to kick off a company that they don't like, authorities bring up those documents. And with this railroad, and you refer to Valdai National Park, I don't know what was the story with that lawsuit, but some people said that one of the reasons why Environmental Protection Committee was abolished, because first state environmental review of this project was very negative. Hmm. And it was, I don't know, it's just rumors. But probably then they had another environmental review which was positive, but probably wasn't as precise as the first one.
Well, I'd like everyone to join me in thanking our panelists.